Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lost in Science. It is the scienciest, the best way to get lost, I think, is to get lost in science. Let's just go back on that. It is the scienciest way to get lost, and it's working for me, as you can quite hear from my ramblings. Stu, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling very well. I'm hoping to find my way out of the science or back into the science or something along those lines. But yeah, this week I am going to be talking about how people are using our favorite generative AI chatbots for all sorts of things they're not designed to be used for, and why that's a big problem when you ask them questions that may have life or death consequences.
Great. Yes, I've had my own kind of, I've got my own anecdotes of bad AI answers people putting a little too much trust in the robots.
Yes, and well, you know, and when it comes down to it, they're designed to give you answers that sound plausible, and that's what they're very good at, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're correct.
I also like to think it's what we're very good at here at Lost in Science as well, that our answers are plausible.
I hope so. I hope they are. We are basing this on, actual studies in science, which I will refer to later on in the show. So it's not just idle opinion. It's actually based on research.
Cool. Well, speaking of research, I've got some stuff for you, Stu. But you know, I hope it's going to keep you happy. So this is actually a follow up from an Ig Nobel story from last year.
Oh wow, I love a follow up on an Ig Nobel story. That's always going to be fun.
So the Ig Nobel prizes, we cover them every year. They are they're kind of the joke Nobel prizes. But they're mostly based on real research, that they put it, research that makes you laugh and then makes you think. Last year, the physics prize went to some expat Italian physicists who were trying to work out the physics behind a perfect pasta sauce. And they were focusing on cacio e pepe, again, apologies if I've got the pronunciation wrong, and trying to work out what the secret was to getting a nice creamy result. It's just a basic pasta with cheese and pepper, essentially. And anyway, they've recently published another sort of short article in Physics Today looking at other pasta sauces as well, and talk about the general kind of, maybe a general theory of pasta sauces. I don't know.
General theory of pastativity.
Yeah, I don't want to go over, cover old ground again, stir the pot too much. But, I thought I would focus on one thing that I've been thinking about a little bit, which is emulsifiers and how emulsifiers play a role in cooking. And so I thought I'd use the Ig Nobels as an excuse to talk a bit cooking science, but particularly emulsifiers. So, yeah, look forward to that.
Yeah, love a bit of cooking science.
Excellent. So, on with the show.
Now, you're old enough, Chris, to remember a time before the internet.
Thanks, Stu.
Hey, it seems like only yesterday that we had to, pull out the phone book and look up people's numbers and call them if we wanted to ask anything. But look, the arrival of accessible internet into people's daily lives in the 90s changed a lot of things. And, many people now have internet access in their pockets at all times, and that's shifted, our behavior even further into various directions, not all of them good, potentially. But one of the most useful things that came from an explosion of internet content was the search engine. Now, I remember some of the early search engines. These went through various iterations. Netscape Navigator was one of the early ones that I recall using. But basically, the arrival of Google kind of conquered all of the search engines and it became a verb in its own right.
I mean, Netscape wasn't really a search. It was a browser, well, I believe. You're thinking more of your Yahoos and your Ask Jesus and things like that.
Yeah, it was a browser. I think, you know, before Google, it was actually pretty hard to find things with, if you didn't know where they were already. But Google kind of completely changed that. Now, admittedly, Google's not as useful as it once was. They've started putting paid results in and things like that, which do alter the accuracy of the search results. And even Google itself has been altered quite dramatically by the availability of a newer technology, which is the large language model generative AI, which if you just go onto Google and you enter in a search term, it will give you an AI overview of what you're searching for, which summarizes multiple information sources. But they're not necessarily all that reliable, and a lot of people have actually opted to turn these off, and there are ways to actually disable the AI overview so you're actually getting results of real websites, because the AI just pulls all sorts of information from all over the place.
I've got to say they have improved a lot in the early days of that service. It was pretty bad. I remember searching for for trivia night reasons, looking up names of birds that might have had back in the name, because I won't explain why. And it said, oh, yes, a bird with the name back in its name is the night parrot. And then sent me a link to something that was nothing to do with night parrots either. So
very, very useful. I mean, that's the thing with the large language models don't really understand anything that they're responding with. So they don't really understand your question. They don't really understand their answers either. But look, there's getting to my point, there is a not insignificant group of people who use LLM chatbots as a kind of search engine on their own, which is fundamentally not what they're designed to do. They're designed to give an answer that reads like natural language. And the way they present the answers that they give is usually with a degree of authority and confidence. But there's no reason to accept that the answers are based on real information. It just sounds like they are. That's what they're designed to do. Now, whether this is a problem depends entirely on how critical that information is. And, you know, historically, hypochondriacs may have discovered mystery symptoms through Dr. Google. But asking LLMs for medical advice is probably not a great healthcare plan. So there's been quite a bit of research into the accuracy of LLMs in this area, and a handful of papers have given varying impressions of the usefulness of these generalized LLMs in answering specifically medical queries. So most recently, in a paper published in the British Medical Journal this month, researchers tested 5 popular LLM chatbots with questions about medicine, and they got experts to rank the responses of these chatbots. So the LLMs they tested were Gemini, which is a Google product, DeepSeek, Meta AI, ChatGPT, and Grok. And they were all asked 10 questions about 5 medical categories, which were cancer, vaccines, stem cells, athletic performance, and nutrition. So then they took these answers and they were rated by 2 experts in each category as to how useful the information and how accurate the information supplied by the chatbots was. And they grouped them into 3 groups, which was non-problematic, somewhat problematic or highly problematic. Now, you know, what would you guess, Chris, that would be the proportion of problematic versus non-problematic answers?
Look, I would actually, depending on the type of question, I mean, they could do fairly well, really. So I'm going to say 50-50. Let's put it that way. I was going to be very cautious to go right down the middle because I think, I mean, that's not great, obviously, if you're relying on these things. You know, if you're asking a fairly obvious question and these things are trained on large amounts of data off the internet, if it's kind of like the accepted consensus result, you'd hope they would give that.
Well, you pretty much nailed it. They found that almost half of the responses were problematic. So 49.6% of the answers were problematic as in some way. 30% were somewhat problematic and 19.6% were highly problematic. So, you know, one in five answers was not accurate is basically what that's telling us. So the quality was similar across all of the LLMs they tested. The authors did note that Grok gave significantly more highly problematic responses than the others in proportion to the somewhat problematic answers from Grok. So Grok had more highly problematic answers than some of the other LLMs. Out of 250 questions they asked, there were only two refusals to answer. So when the LLM said, no, I'm not going to answer that.
Oh, really?
And that was that. Both of those were from Meta AI. So whether they've got different guardrails built in or something, I'm not sure, but that was the only LLM that said, no, I'm not going to answer the question. And it only did that twice out of 250. So total. And all the answers are presented as factual with no indication of any doubt or uncertainty in the answers. They're saying that they come across as that they are telling you the real deal. They also were asked to present references, but all of the LLMs presented fabricated sources and hallucinations. So none of them had a reliable, accurate reference list. In this testing, the accuracy of their responses varied by topic. The most accurate information was given on vaccines and cancer, and they gave worse information on stem cells, athletic performance, and nutrition. And I guess maybe that's because they're a bit more broad topics, I suppose, and
or they're cutting edge more. Well, I mean, stem cells is still a research kind of topic, I suppose, in many ways. What was the other one? Sorry.
Athletic performance and nutrition also. So it's not giving good dietary advice.
Well, those have a lot of misinformation out there. I mean, again, if they're trained off the internet, there's a lot of, kind of theories and non-scientific ideas out there that it could glean from.
Yeah. It's not, it's easy to see why that would be a problem. They also found that the readability of the answers given was uniformly difficult across all of the LLMs. They said the reading capability required is that of a university undergraduate to understand the content that they delivered. Basically, what they found was that it's a really bad idea to use a general purpose LLM as a search engine, especially for high risk topics like medical information, which you want to be very accurate. And that's not to say that LLMs won't be developed for this purpose, but they would need to be designed specifically for the function of giving medical advice, not just a random chatbot on the internet. And they need to have much more stringent guardrails built in to prevent that misinformation being propagated and spread by feeding off the wild west that is the internet. Now, you know, in Australia, we are lucky enough to have a reasonably functional healthcare system through which we can access good quality medical advice from qualified medical professionals. So that would be a good thing to do. And we even do have, you know, there's on-call 24-hour medical advice hotlines that you can ring as well, things like that. So no need to rely on Grok to give you the lowdown on your medical needs. There's really just no need to rely on something that's programmed to impress us by pretending it knows everything, and also programmed to appear like it has no doubt about anything that it tells you. It's just what they're built for, and that's how they come across. So, yeah.
I'm looking for a pun. Something about the Dunning-Kruger machines. No.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
You're listening to Lost in Science, and we are heading back into the kitchen to revisit, as I said, an Ig Nobel story from last year. So just to remind you once again, this was some Italian physicists who were trying to work out the secret behind cacio e pepe, a simple pasta made out of cheese and pepper, essentially. But how do you get it a nice creamy texture? It's, you know, there's a lot of skill to involve to it, but they tried to work out what is involved. And look, it was quite an interesting bit of work there. They came up with their sort of idealized recipe, which is not necessarily that practical for a quick cook, but perhaps it may be
a quick dinner.
Yeah, but then again, maybe it's quicker than getting years of practice to perfect it. So essentially what it is that, so essentially the problem is that you mix in the grated cheese, pecorino, I think in this case, into the pasta, and the proteins in it denature, and instead of getting a creamy result, you get kind of this lumpy thing as the proteins sort of aggregate into clumps. What you do instead, you add some starchy water, which is often taken from the water the pasta was cooked in, and that then helps prevent the proteins clumping up, because the at above a certain temperature, the starches release sugars that then kind of gelatinize, they call it, increases the viscosity, but also gets in the way of the lumps aggregating, and that helps get it all creamy. The trouble is, this only works, you have to get it just the right temperature for this to work, essentially, like that. You don't want it too hot that the proteins are going to denature, but you also need to have had the pasta water kind of hot enough to get this gelatinization, and then maybe cooled down a bit and thickened somehow. So it's that is where the I guess the art comes into it. So yeah, that was the basics of that. But then, as I said, they published a new article in the it's a magazine, really. Let's not pretend it's a physics journal. Physics Today, talking about, I guess, the general kind of ideas of pasta. And one of the things they touched on is another famous pasta dish, carbonara. You may have heard of, Stu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bacon and or pancetta and I think egg, or is it supposed to be cream?
It's egg, pecorino is the cheese, I say, and they actually say it's guanciale, which is cured pork jowl rather than bacon,
right.
But you know, people generally use bacon, it's much the same sort of thing. Look, it's a similar kind of deal. In this case, though, there's obviously going to be a lot of fat in there from the bacon and stuff like that, and from the cheese. And one of the secrets to this is that the egg yolks have emulsifiers in them, primarily lecithin. And egg yolk is often used in cooking as an emulsifier, which is a thing that helps you get this kind of nice consistency when you have fatty substances mixed with watery substances. So yeah, it's kind of, it helps you get this nice creamy mixture. And as I said, a bit of a secret to a lot of things. Stu, do you know much about emulsifiers or emulsions and that sort of thing?
Not a huge amount. I mean, it's always used to see them as an ingredient in, you know, processed foods and things like that. And never really had a grasp of what they actually did, except that, yeah, they kind of keep packaged foods in a condition that keeps them usable for longer, I suppose, is what I kind of assumed they were doing in there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's to a large extent that's what we're doing, and I'll perhaps give you some examples of that. That is essentially what they are. So emulsifiers, they help you get an emulsion, which is essentially a mixture of oil and water. And as the famous saying goes, oil and water don't mix.
Mm.
They generally are incompatible, but there are ways to force them to mix. And in particular, using these substances, emulsifiers are a type of surfactant. And surfactants are chemicals that basically have, they've got two ends. One end is attracted to water. It's called hydrophilic. The other end is not attracted to water. It's called hydrophobic. And so that more attracts to the oils and things. So basically they're an in-between thing. They have one end that goes for the water, it's going, and then it goes for the oils, and they help get them to play together nicely.
Mm.
A good example of this is detergent, which is, you know, you're washing out detergent that you use. You know, it's one of its main jobs is to remove greasy, oily residue off dishes, and does that within water. And what it does is these things dissolve in water and they pick up the oil off the plates and things.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty basic concept. It also helped answer a question, another digression that I had recently. I've been wondering what micellar water is, this thing that they sell for like makeup remover and stuff like that at ridiculous prices. Have you heard of micellar water at all?
I have heard of it. I just never really thought about what it was. I just, you know, I tend to ignore a lot of the cosmetic aisle.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like some sort of made-up thing. It's basically a fancy name for, I guess, water with a lot of detergent in it. So micelles are little kind of, I suppose, droplets of surfactants. So in this case, whenever you have enough of them in water, then they reach a point where they fall little balls where all the hydrophilic, the ones like water, ends of the molecules stick outwards, and the hydrophobic ones, which are the ones attracted to oil, are inside the middle of these kind of droplets. And so you get all these little droplets called micelles within in the suspension, and that is your micellar water. Clearly, there is something special about it. It is probably more in the type of detergent that's used. It's not just everyday washing detergent.
It's not morning fresh.
No, it's not going to be even the one that you're soaking in it and it still is good for your hands. There'd be something a lot gentler, you know, if it's going to be used rubbing on your face, essentially like that. But that's basically the idea. It is a fancy name for just water with a lot of surfactant in it. But yeah, so that is quite useful in cleaning, as I said, but they're also useful in cooking for getting mixtures of, say, oil and water, because these are things that often happen in cooking. You know, there's a lot of these things we don't want to separate, we don't want to split up. So another good example that is that where you want to get mixed oil and water often is in a salad dressing.
Yeah.
So they often have things like a simple vinaigrette has olive oil and vinegar.
Yeah.
And vinegar is like it's acidic, but it's basically water, essentially, like flavored water, I suppose. And again, these things don't really mix well. You can mix them up by say, shaking them vigorously or putting them in a blender or this sort of thing. And that is actually another way of creating an emulsion. What you're doing is you're breaking up the, say, the oil droplets into the liquid, and they're getting tiny, tiny droplets. Really quick stirring is often a part of these dishes as well, to mix them together. But yeah, in this particular case, you can do that, but they will separate eventually, the oil and the vinegar. And you can help them stay together, though, by adding an emulsifier. Often there are things like mustard is an emulsifier, so a little bit of mustard in your salad dressing will help it stay nice, creamy consistency. Honey is another one. Or, again, egg yolks, which basically is the secret behind mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Is the thing that helps make mayonnaise nice and creamy. So it is these emulsifiers that are the secret to a lot of this stuff. So yeah, again, when you're looking at something like carbonara, going back to that, that is, I guess, one of the secrets to what keeping that creamy is the egg yolks. Again, though, temperature becomes a factor here, because the proteins and other chemicals within the egg yolk, they will change and start to like coagulate and stuff at about 65 degrees. So you don't want adding your egg in super hot.
Mm.
You need to get it below, I guess, the boiling point of water at least. So about 65 degrees is what you need to have it not turn into like scrambled egg or lumpy egg kind of things. And so, yeah, getting the temperature just right is very important to this, as is, you know, like the stirring. Sometimes these recipes will ask you to stir it vigorously. That is a real thing, because you need to break out the droplets to get it nice and creamy, get nice small droplets as opposed to large lumps of fat. But yeah, look, I think it's something worth considering when you're cooking. You're adding these little bits and things. Sometimes they're not just for flavor. Sometimes they're doing a chemical job, and you know, cooking is just basically yummy chemistry when it comes down to it. And that's it for another episode of Lost in Science. Lost in Science is recorded for 3CR in Melbourne on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And it airs across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We would love you to get in touch with us. You can email us at lostinsci@gmail.com, or you can find us on Facebook, we're Lost in Science on 3CR, or on Twitter, where we're at lostinscience1. You can find us on your favourite podcast app, where if you get the chance, please give us a good rating and review, as that will raise us up in the search rankings so other people can find the science. Or you can listen to us however you listen to us now, where the same time every week, Claire, Stu and Chris get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.